didn't have a scary edge. Frank said, "What?" Before Bobby could even start to explain, he saw that someone actually was heading in their general direction through the obscuring rain. It was a dark figure, not Lisa, a man, and he was only about 30 yards away. He hadn't been there a moment ago. "It's him," Frank said. Even at a distance, the guy looked big. He spotted them and turned directly toward them. Bobby said, "Get us out of here, Frank."
"I can't do it on demand, you know that?"
"Then let's run," he urged. And he tried to pull Frank along the beach toward the abandoned lifeguard tower and whatever lay beyond. But after floundering a few steps through the sand, Frank stopped and said,
"No, I can't. I'm worn out. I'm going to have to pray that I pop out of here in time."
He looked worse than worn out. He looked half dead. Bobby turned toward Candy again and saw the dark brother slogging through the soft, wet sand much faster than they had managed, but still with some difficulty. "Why doesn't he just teleport from there to here in a flash, overwhelm us?" Frank's horror at the sight of his oncoming nemesis was so complete that he didn't appear capable of speech. Yet the words came with the shallow breaths that rasped out of him.
"Short hops under 100 feet aren't possible. Don't know why."
Maybe if the trip was too short, the mind had a fraction of a second less than the minimum time required to deconstruct and fully reconstruct the body. It didn't matter what the reason was. Even if he couldn't teleport across the remaining stretch of sand, Candy was going to reach them in seconds. He was only 30 feet away in closing, a massive juggernaut of a man, with a neck thick enough to support a car balanced on his head, and arms that would give him an advantage in a wrestling match with a 4-ton industrial robot. His blonde hair was almost white. His face was broad and sharp-featured and hard, and as cruel as the face of one of those pre-psychotic young boys who like to set ants on fire with matches and test the effects of full-strength lye on neighborhood dogs. Charging through the storm, kicking up gouts of wet black sand with each step, he looked less like a man than like a demon with a fierce hunger for human souls. Holding fast to his client's hand, Bobby said, "Frank, for God's sake, let's get out of here." When Candy was close enough for Bobby to see blue eyes as wild and vicious as those of a rattlesnake on Benzedrine, he let out a wordless roar of triumph. He flung himself at them. Darkness. Fireflies. Velocity. Pale morning light filtered from a clear sky into the narrow pass-through between two rotting, ramshackle buildings so crusted in the filth of ages that it was impossible to determine what material had been used to construct their walls. Bobby and Frank were standing in knee-deep garbage that had been tossed out of the windows of the two-story structures and left to decompose in a reeking sludge that steamed like a compost pile. Their magical arrival had startled a colony of roaches that scuttled away from them and caused swarms of fat black flies to leap up from their breakfast. Several sleek rats sat up on their haunches to see what had arrived among them, but they were too bold to be scared off. The tenements on both sides had some windows completely open to the outside, some covered with what looked like oiled paper, none with glass. Though no people were in sight, from the rooms within the aged walls came voices, laughter here, an angry exchange there, chanting as of a mantra softly drifting down from the second floor of the building on the right. It was all in a foreign tongue with which Bobby was not familiar, though he suspected they might be in India, perhaps Bombay or Calcutta. Because of the ineluctable stench, which by comparison made the stink of a slaughterhouse seem like a new perfume by Calvin Klein, and because of the insistently buzzing flies that exhibited great interest in an open mouth and nostrils, Bobby was unable to get his breath. He choked, put his free hand over his mouth, still could not breathe, and knew he was going to faint face first into the vile, steaming muck. Darkness. Fireflies. Velocity. In a place of stillness and silence, shafts of afternoon sunshine pierced mimosa branches and dappled the ground with golden light. They stood on a red oriental footbridge over a koi pond in a Japanese garden, where sculpted bonsai and other meticulously tended plants were positioned among carefully raked beds of pebbles. "Oh, yes," Frank said with a mixture of wonder and pleasure and relief. "Oh, yes, I lived here, too, for a while." They were alone in the garden. Bobby realized that Frank always materialized in sheltered places where he was unlikely to be seen in the act, or in circumstances such as the middle of a cloudburst, that almost ensured even a public place like a beach would be conveniently deserted. Evidently, in addition to the unimaginably demanding task of deconstruction, travel, reconstruction, his mind was also capable of scouting the way ahead and choosing a discreet point of arrival. Frank said, "I was the longest residing guest they'd ever had. It's a traditional Japanese inn on the outskirts of Kyoto." Bobby became aware that they were both totally dry. Their clothes were wrinkled in need of an ironing, but when Frank had deconstructed them in Hawaii, he had not teleported the molecules of water that had saturated their clothes and hair. "They were so kind here," Frank said, "respectful of my privacy, yet so attentive and kind." He sounded wistful and terminally weary, as if he would have liked to have stopped his traveling right there, even if stopping meant dying at the hands of his brother. Bobby was relieved to see that Frank also had not brought with them any of the slime from the narrow alley in Calcutta, or wherever. Their shoes and pants were clean. Then he noticed something on the toe of his right shoe. He bent forward to look at it. "I wish we could stay here," Frank said, "forever." One of the roaches from that filth-choked alley was now a part of Bobby's footwear. One of the biggest advantages of being self-employed was freedom from neckties and uncomfortable shoes, so he was wearing, as usual, a pair of soft Rockport Super Sports, and the roach was not merely stuck on the putty-colored leather, but bristling from it and melded with it. The roach was not squirming, obviously dead, but it was there, or at least part of it was, some bits of it apparently having been left behind. "But we've got to keep moving," Frank said, oblivious of the roach. "He's trying to follow us. We have to lose him if..." Darkness. Fireflies. Velocity. They were on a high place, a rocky trail, with an incredible panorama below them. "Mount Fuji," Frank said, not as if he had known where they were going, but as if pleasantly surprised to be there. "Mount Fuji, about halfway up." Bobby was not interested in the exotic view or concerned about the chill in the air. He was entirely preoccupied by the discovery that the roach was no longer a part of the toe of his shoe. "The Japanese once thought Fuji was sacred. I guess they still do, or some of them do. And you can see why. It's magnificent." "Frank, what happened to the roach?"
What roach?"
"There was a roach welded into the leather of this shoe. I saw it back there in the garden. You evidently brought it along from that disgusting alleyway. Where is it now?"
I don't know."
"Did you just drop its atoms along the way?"
"I don't know."
"Or are its atoms still with me, but somewhere else?"
"Bobby, I just don't know."
In Bobby's mind was an image of his own heart, hidden within the dark cavity of his chest, beating with the mystery of all hearts, but with a new secret all its own, the bristling legs and shiny carapace of a roach, embedded in the muscle tissue that formed the walls of the atrium or a ventricle. An insect might be inside of him, and even if the thing was dead, its presence within was intolerable. An attack of entomophobia hit him with the equivalent force of a hammer blow to the gut, knocking the wind out of him, sending undulate waves of nausea through him, He struggled to breathe, at the same time striving not to vomit on the sacred ground of Mount Fuji. Darkness. Fireflies. Velocity. They hit more violently this time, as if they had materialized in midair and had fallen a few feet onto the ground. They didn't manage to hold on to each other, and they didn't land on their feet either. Separated from Frank, Bobby rolled down a gentle incline over small objects that clattered and clicked under him and poked painfully into his flesh. When he tumbled to a halt, gasping and frightened, he was face down on gray soil almost as powdery as ashes. Scattered around him, sparkling brightly against that ashen backdrop, were hundreds, if not thousands, of red diamonds in the rough. Raising his head, he saw that the diamond miners were there in unnerving numbers. A score of huge insects, just like the one they had taken to Dyson Manfred. Caught, as he was, in the whirlpool of panic, Bobby believed that every one of those bugs was fixated on him. All those multifaceted eyes turned towards him. All those tarantula legs churning through the powdery gray soil in his direction. He felt something crawling on his back, knew what it must be, and rolled over, pinning the thing between him and the ground. He felt it squirming frantically beneath him. Propelled by repulsion, he was suddenly on his feet without quite remembering how he had gotten up. The bug was still clinging to the back of his shirt. He could feel its weight, its quick-footed advance from the small of his back to his neck. He reached behind, tore it off himself, cried out in disgust as it kicked against his hand, and pitched it as far away as he could. He heard himself breathing hard and making queer little sounds of fear and desperation. He didn't like what he heard, but he was unable to silence himself. A foul taste filled his mouth. He figured he had ingested some of the powdery soil he spat, but his spittle looked clean, and he realized that the air itself was what he tasted. The warm air was thick, not humid exactly, but thick, like nothing he'd experienced before. And in addition to the bitter taste, it had a distinctly different but equally unpleasant smell, like sour milk with a whiff of sulfur. Turning around, surveying the terrain, he realized that he was standing in a shallow bowl in the land about 4 feet deep at its lowest point and about 100 feet in diameter. The sloped walls were marked by evenly spaced holes, a double layer of them, and more of the biologically engineered insects were squirming into some of those bores, out of others, no doubt seeking and returning with diamonds. Because it was only 4 feet deep, he could see above the rim of the bowl. Across the huge, barren, and slightly sloped plain in which this depression was set, he saw what appeared to be scores of similar features like age-smooth meteor craters, though they were so evenly spaced that they had to be unnatural. He was in the middle of a giant mining operation. Kicking at an insect that had crept too close to him, Bobby turned to look at the last quarter of his surroundings. Frank was there, at the far side of the crater, on his hands and knees. Bobby was relieved by the sight of him, but he was definitely not relieved by what he saw in the sky beyond Frank. The moon was visible in broad daylight, but it was not like the gossamer ghost moon that sometimes could be seen in the clear sky. It was a mottled gray-yellow sphere, 6 times normal size, looming ominously over the land, as if about to collide with the larger world around which it should have been revolving at a respectable distance. But that was not the worst. A huge and strangely shaped aircraft hung silently at perhaps an altitude of 400 or 500 feet. So alien in every aspect that it brought home to Bobby the understanding that had thus far eluded him. He was not on his own world any longer. "Julie," he said, because suddenly he realized how terribly far from her he had traveled. At the far side of the crater, as he was getting to his feet, Frank Pollard vanished.
As day dimmed and dark came, Thomas stood at the window, or sat in his chair, or stretched out on his bed, sometimes reaching toward the bad thing to be sure it wasn't coming closer. Bobby was worried when he visited, so Thomas was worried too. A lump of fear kept rising in his throat, but he kept swallowing it because he had to be brave and protect Julie. He didn't get as close to the bad thing as last night, not close enough to let it grab him with its mind, not close enough to let it follow him when he quick-like reeled his own mind string back to the home, but close, a lot closer than Thomas liked. Every time he pushed at the bad thing to make sure it was still there up north someplace where it belonged, he knew the bad thing felt him snooping. That spooked Thomas. The bad thing knew he was snooping around, but didn't do anything. And sometimes Thomas felt maybe the bad thing was waiting like a toad. Once, in the garden behind the home, Thomas watched a toad sitting real still for a long time, while a bright yellow flutterby, pretty and quick, bounced from leaf to leaf, flower to flower, back and forth, round and round, close to the toad, then not so close, then closer than ever, then way out of reach, then closer again, like it was teasing the toad, but the toad didn't move, not an inch, like maybe it was a fake toad, or just a stone that looked like a toad. So the flutterby felt safe, and maybe it just liked the game too much, and it came even closer. Wham! The toad's tongue shot out like one of those roll-up tooters they'd let the dumb people have one New Year's Eve, and it caught the flutterby, and the green toad ate the yellow flutterby every bit, and that was the end of the game. If the bad thing was playing a toad, Thomas was going to be real careful not to be a flutterby. Then, just as Thomas figured he should start washing himself and changing clothes for supper, just when he was going to pull back from the bad thing, it went somewhere. He felt it go, bang. There one second, and far away the next, slipping past where he could keep a watch on it, out across the world, going the same place where the sun was taking the last of the daylight. He couldn't figure how it could go so fast, unless maybe it was on a jet plane, having good food and fine wine, smiling at pretty girls in uniforms who put little pillows behind the bad thing's seat and gave it magazines and smiled back at it so nice and so much you expected them to kiss it like everybody was always kissing on daytime TV. Okay, yeah, probably a jet plane. Thomas tried some more to find the bad thing. Then, by the time day was all gone and night all there, he gave up. He got off his bed and got ready for supper, hoping maybe the bad thing was gone away and never coming back, hoping Julie was safe forever now, and hoping there was chocolate cake for dessert.
Bobby charged across the floor of the diamond-strewn crater, kicking at the bugs in his way. As he ran, he told himself that his eyes had deceived him, and that his mind was playing nasty tricks, that Frank had not actually teleported out of there without him. But when he arrived at the spot where Frank had been, he found only a couple of footprints in the pottery soil. A shadow fell across him, and he looked up as the alien craft drifted in blimp-like silence over the crater, coming to a full stop directly above him, still about 500 feet overhead. It was nothing like starships in the movies, neither organic-looking nor a flying chandelier. It was lozenge-shaped, at least 500 feet long, and perhaps 200 feet in diameter. Immense. On the ends, sides, and top, it bristled with hundreds, if not thousands, of pointed black metal spines, big as church spires, which made it look a little like a mechanical porcupine in a permanent defensive posture. The underside, which Bobby could see best of all, was smooth, black, and featureless, lacking not only the massive spines, but markings, remote sensors, portholes, airlocks, and all the other apparatus one might expect. Bobby did not know if the ship's repositioning was coincidental or whether he was under observation. If he was being watched, he didn't want to think about the nature of the creatures that might be peering down at him, and he sure as hell didn't want to consider what their intentions toward him might be. For every movie that featured an adorable alien with the power to turn kids' bicycles into airborne vehicles, there were 10 others in which the aliens were ravenous flesh-eaters with dispositions so vicious as to make any New York headwaiter think twice about being rude. And Bobby was certain that this was one thing Hollywood had gotten right. It was a hostile universe out there, and dealing with his fellow human beings was scary enough for him. He didn't need to make contact with a whole new race that had devised countless new cruelties of its own. Besides, his capacity for terror was already filled to the brim, running over. He could contain no more. He was abandoned on a distant world where the air, he began to suspect, might contain only enough oxygen and other required gases to keep him alive for a short while. Insects the size of kittens were crawling all around him, and there was a possibility that a much smaller dead insect was actually fused with the tissue of one of his internal organs. And a psychotic blonde giant with superhuman powers and a taste for blood was on his trail. And the odds were billions to one that he would ever see Julie again, or kiss her, or touch her, or see her smile. A series of tremendous throbbing vibrations issued from the ship and shook the ground around Bobby. His teeth chattered and he nearly fell. He looked for somewhere to hide. There was nothing in the crater to afford concealment, and nowhere to run on the flat plain beyond. The vibrations stopped. Even in the deep shadow thrown by the ship, Bobby saw a horde of identical insects begin to scuttle out of the boreholes in the crater walls one after the other. They had been called forth. Though no apparent openings appeared in the belly of the ship, a score or more of low-energy lasers, some yellow, some white, some blue, some red, began to play over the floor of the crater. Each beam was the diameter of a silver dollar, and each moved independently of the others. Like spotlights, they repeatedly swept the crater and everything in it, sometimes moving parallel to one another, sometimes crisscrossing one another, in a display that further disoriented Bobby and gave him the feeling that he was caught in the middle of a silent fireworks show. He remembered what Manfred and Gavinal had told him about the crimson decorations along the rim of the bug shell, and he saw that the white lasers were focusing only on the insects, busily scanning the markings around each carapace. Their owners were taking roll call. He saw a white beam fidget over the broken corpus of one of the bugs he had kicked, and after a moment, a red beam joined it to study the carcass. Then the red beam jumped to Bobby, and a couple of other beams of different hue also found him, as if he was a can of peas being identified and added to someone's grocery bill at a supermarket checkout. The floor of the crater was teeming with insects now, so many that Bobby could see neither the gray soil nor the litter of excreted diamonds over which they clambered. He told himself that they were not really bugs. They were just biological machines, engineered by the same race that had built the ship hanging over him. But that didn't help much because they still looked more like bugs than like machines. They had been designed to mine diamonds. They were not attracted to him whatsoever. But their disinterest did not make him feel better because his phobia guaranteed that he was interested in them. His shadow-chilled skin prickled with goose flesh. Short-circuiting nerve endings sputtered with false reports of things crawling on him, so he felt as if bugs swarmed over him from head to foot. They were actually creeping over his shoes, but none of them tried to scurry up his legs. He was grateful, because he was sure he would go mad if they began to climb him. He used his hand as a visor over his eyes to avoid being dazzled by the lasers that were playing on him. He saw something gleaming in the scanner beams only a few feet away, a curved section of what appeared to be hollow steel tubing. It was sticking out of the powdery soil, partly buried, further concealed by the bugs that scurried and jittered around it. Nevertheless, at first sight, Bobby knew what it was, and he was overcome with a horrible sinking feeling. He shuffled forward, trying not to crush any of the insects because, for all he knew, the alien penalty for the additional destruction of property might be instant incineration. When he could reach the glinting curve of metal, he seized it and pulled it loose of the soft earth. It was the missing railing from the hospital bed.
"How long?" Julie demanded. 21 minutes. Clint said. They still stood near the chair where Frank had been sitting, and beside which Bobby had been stooping. Lee Chen had gotten off the sofa so Jackie Jacks could lie down. The magician hypnotist had draped a damp washcloth over his forehead. Every couple of minutes he protested that he could not really make people disappear, though no one had accused him of being responsible for what had happened to Frank and Bobby. Having retrieved a bottle of scotch, glasses, and ice from the office wet bar, Lee Chen was pouring 6 stiff drinks, one for each person in the room, as well as for Frank and Bobby. "If you don't need a drink to steady your nerves now," Lee had said, "you'll need one to celebrate when they come back safe." He had already downed 1 scotch himself. The drink he poured now would be his 2nd. This was the first time in his life he had drunk hard liquor, or needed it. "How long?" Julie demanded. 22 minutes," Clint said. "And I'm still sane," she thought wonderingly. "Bobby, damn you, come back to me. Don't you leave me alone forever. How am I going to dance alone? How am I going to live alone? How am I going to live?"
Bobby dropped the bed railing, and the lasers winked off, leaving him in the shadow of the spiny ship, which seemed darker than before the beams appeared. As he looked up to see what would happen next, another light issued from the underside of the craft, too pale to make him squint. This one was precisely the diameter of a crater. In that queer, pearly glow, the insects began to rise off the ground, as if they were weightless. At first only 10 or 20 floated upward, but then 20 more, and 100 after that, rising as lazily and effortlessly as so many bits of dandelion fluff, turning slowly, their tarantula legs motionless, the eerie light gone out of their eyes, as if they had been switched off. In a minute or two, the floor of the crater was depopulated of insects, and the horde was being drawn up effortlessly in that sepulchral silence that accompanied all of the craft's maneuvers, except for the bass vibrations that had called the insect miners from their bores. Then, the silence was broken by a flute-like warble. "Frank!" Bobby cried in relief and turned as a gust of vile-smelling wind washed over him. As the cold, hollow piping echoed across the crater again, there was a subtle change in the hue of the light that issued from the ship above. Now the thousands of red diamonds rose from the ash-gray soil in which they lay and followed the insects upward, gleaming dully here and brightly there, so many of them that it seemed as if Bobby was standing in a rain of blood. Another whirl of evil-scented wind cast up a cloud of the ashy soil, reducing visibility, and Bobby turned in eager expectation of Frank's arrival, until he remembered that it might not be Frank, but the brother. The piping came a 3rd time, and the subsequent puff of wind carried the dust away from him, so he saw Frank arrive less than 10 feet from him. Thank God. As Bobby stepped forward, the pearly light underwent a 2nd subtle change. Reaching for Frank's hand, he felt himself become weightless. When he looked down, he saw his feet drift off the floor of the crater. Frank grabbed at his outstretched hand and seized it. Nothing had ever felt better to Bobby than Frank's firm grip, and for a moment he felt safe. Then he became aware that Frank had risen from the ground, too. They were both being drawn upward in the wake of the insects and diamonds, toward the belly of the alien vessel, toward God only knew what nightmare inside. Darkness. Fireflies. Velocity. They were on Punalau Beach again, and the rain was coming down harder than before. "Where the hell was that last place?" Bobby demanded, still holding fast to his client.
"I don't know," Frank said. "It scares the hell out of me. It's so weird, but sometimes I seem to be drawn there."
He hated Frank for having taken him there. He loved Frank for having returned for him. When he shouted above the rain, neither love nor hate was in his voice, just borderline hysteria.
"I thought you could only travel to places you've been."
"Not necessarily. Anyway, I've been there before."
But how did you get there the first time? It's another world. It can't have been familiar to you, right, Frank?
I don't know. I just don't understand any of it, Bobby.
Though face to face with Frank, Bobby took a while to notice how much the man's appearance had deteriorated since they had teleported from the Dakota and Dakota offices in Newport Beach. Although the storm once more had soaked him to the skin in seconds and left his clothes hanging on him shapelessly, it wasn't just the rain that made him look disheveled, beaten, and sickly. His eyes were more sunken than ever. The whites of them were yellow, as if he had contracted jaundice, and the flesh around them was so darkly bruised that he appeared to have painted a pair of fake shiners on himself with black shoe polish. His skin was paler than pale, a deathly gray, and his lips were bluish as though his circulatory system was failing. Bobby felt guilty about having shouted at him, so he put his free hand on Frank's shoulder and told him he was sorry, that it was all right, that they were still fighting on the same side of this war, and that everything would turn out just fine, as long as Frank didn't take them back to that crater. Frank said,
"Sometimes it's like I'm almost in touch with the minds of those people, creatures, whatever they are, in that ship."
They were leaning on each other now, forehead to forehead, seeking mutual support in their exhaustion.
"Maybe I've got another gift I'm not aware of. Like, for most of my life I wasn't aware of being able to teleport until Candy backed me into a corner and tried to kill me. Maybe I'm mildly telepathic. Maybe the wavelength my telepathy functions on is the major wavelength of that race's brain activity. Maybe I feel them out there, even across billions of light years of space. Maybe that's why I feel as if I'm being drawn to them, called to them."
Pulling back a few inches from Frank, Bobby looked into his tortured eyes for a long moment. Then he smiled and pinched Frank's cheek and said,
"You devil, you've really done a lot of thinking about this, haven't you? Really put the old noodle to work on it, huh?"
Frank smiled. Bobby laughed.
Then they were both laughing, holding each other up by leaning into each other, the way teepee poles held one another up. And a part of their laugh was healthy, a release of tension, but part of it was that mad laughter that had troubled Bobby earlier. Clinging to his client, he said, "Frank, your life is chaos. You're living in chaos, and you can't go on like this. It's going to destroy you."
"I know."
"You've got to find a way to stop it."
"There is no way."
"You got to try, buddy. You've got to try. Nobody can handle this. I couldn't live like this for one day, and you've done it for 7 years.
"No, it wasn't this bad most of that time. It's just lately, the last few months, it's accelerated."
"A few months," Bobby said wonderingly. "Hell, if we don't give your brother the slip soon and get back to the office and step off this merry-go-round in the next few minutes, I swear to God I'm going to crack. Frank, I need order. Order and stability, familiarity. I need to know that what I do today will determine where I am and who I am and what I have to show for it tomorrow. Nice, orderly progression, Frank. Cause and effect, logic and reason."
Darkness. Fireflies. Velocity.
"How long?" 27, almost 28 minutes. "Where the hell are they?" "Julie," Clint said, "I think you want to sit down. You're shaking like a leaf. Your color's not good." "I'm all right." Li Chen handed her a glass of scotch. "Have a drink." "No." "It might help," Clint said. She grabbed the glass from Li, drained it in a couple of long swallows, and shoved it back into his hand. "I'll get you another," he said. "Thanks." From the sofa, Jackie Jack said, "Listen, is anyone going to sue me over this?" Julie no longer sort of liked the hypnotist. She loathed him, as much as she had loathed him when they had first met him in Vegas and taken on his case. She wanted to go kick his head in. Though she knew the urge to kick him was irrational, that he really had not been the cause of Bobby's disappearance. She wanted to kick him anyway. That was the impulsive side of her, the quick-to-anger side of which she was not proud. But she couldn't always control it, because it was part of her genetic makeup, or, as Bobby suspected, a predilection to violent response that had begun to form in her on the day in her childhood when a drug-crazed sociopath had brutally killed her mother. Either way, she knew Bobby was sometimes dismayed by that dark side of her, much as he loved everything else. So she made a bargain with both Bobby and God. "Listen, Bobby, wherever you are, and you listen too, God, if this just ends well, if I can just have my Bobby back with me, I won't be this way anymore. I won't want to kick in Jackie's head anymore, or anyone else's head either. I'll turn over a new leaf. I swear I will. Just let Bobby come back to me, safe and sound."
They were on a beach again, but this one had white sand that was slightly phosphorescent in the early darkness. The strand disappeared into a medium-thick fog in both directions. No rain was falling, and the air was not as warm as it had been on Punalu. Bobby shivered in the chill, moist air. "Where are we?"
"I'm not sure," Frank said. "But I think we're probably on the Monterey Peninsula somewhere."
A car passed on a highway 100 yards behind them.
"That's probably a 17-mile drive. You know it? The road from Carmel through Pebble Beach?"
"I know it."
"I love the peninsula, Big Sur to the south," Frank said. "It's another one of the places I was happy for a while."
Their voices were strangely muffled by the mist. Bobby liked the solid ground beneath his feet and the thought that he was not only on his own planet, but in his own country and in his own state. But he would have preferred a place with more concrete details, where fog did not obscure the landscape. The white blindness of fog was another form of chaos, and he had had more than enough disorder to last him for the rest of his life. Frank said,
"Oh, and by the way, back there in Hawaii a minute ago, you were worried about giving Candy the slip, but you don't need to be concerned. We lost him several stops ago in Kyoto, or maybe on the slopes of Mount Fuji."
"For God's sake, if we don't have to worry about leading him back to the office, let's go home."
"Bobby, I don't have..."
"Any control, yeah, I know, I heard. It's no big secret. But I'll tell you something. You've got control on some level, way down deep in the subconscious, more control than you think you have."
"No, I..."
"Yes, because you came back to that crater for me," Bobby said. "You told me you hate the place, that it's more frightening than anywhere you've ever been.
But you came back and got me. You didn't leave me there with a bed railing. Pure chance that I came back."
"I don't think so." Darkness. Fireflies. Velocity.
They made the soft, pretty bing-bong signal come out of the wall, because that was how they told all the people in the home it was just 10 minutes before supper was going to be eaten. Derek was already out the door by the time Thomas got up from his chair. Derek liked food. Everyone liked food, of course, but Derek liked food enough for 3 people. Thomas got to the doorway, and Derek was already down the hall, walking fast in that funny way he did, almost to the dining room. Thomas looked back at the window. Night was at the window. He didn't like seeing night at the window, which was why he usually kept the drapes closed after the light went out of the world. But after he got himself ready for supper, he had tried to find the bad thing out there, and it helped a little to see the night when he was trying to send a mind string into it. The bad thing was still so far away it couldn't be felt, but he wanted to try once more before going to eat food and be sociable. He reached out through the window, up into the big dark, spinning the mind string toward where the bad thing used to be. And it was back. He felt it right away, knew it felt him too, and he remembered the green toad eating the bouncy yellow flutterby, and he pulled back into his room faster than a toad tongue could snap out and catch him. He didn't know if he should be happy or scared that it was back, When it was gone away, Thomas was happy because maybe it was going to be gone away a long time. But he was also a little scared because when it was gone away, he didn't know exactly where it was. It was back. He waited in the doorway a while. Then he went to eat food. There was roast chicken, there was French fries, there was carrots and peas, there was coleslaw, there was homemade bread, and people said there was going to be some chocolate cake and ice cream for dessert, though the people that said it was dumb people, so you couldn't be sure. It all looked good, and it smelled good, and it even tasted good. But Thomas kept thinking about how the Flutterby might have tasted to the toad, and he couldn't eat much of anything.
Bouncing like two balls in tandem, they traveled to an empty lot in Las Vegas, where a cool desert wind spun a tumbleweed past them, and where Frank said he had once lived in a house that was now demolished, to that cabin at the top of a snowy mountain meadow where they had first teleported after leaving the office, to the graveyard in Santa Barbara, to the top of an Aztec ziggurat in the lush Mexican jungles, where the humid night air was full of buzzing mosquitoes and the cries of unknown beasts, and where Bobby almost fell down the terraced side of the pyramidal structure before he realized how high they were and how precariously perched, to the offices of Dakota and Dakota. They were popping around so quickly, remaining in each place such a brief time, in fact briefer with each stop, that for a moment he stood in the corner of his own office, blinking stupidly before he realized where he was and what he had to do. He tore his hand away from Frank and he said, "Stop it now. Stop here." But Frank vanished even as Bobby spoke. Julie was all over him an instant later, hugging him so tightly that she hurt his ribs. He hugged her, too, and kissed her a long time before coming up for air. Her hair smelled clean, and her skin smelled sweeter than he remembered. Her eyes were brighter than memory allowed, and more beautiful. Though by nature he was not much of a toucher, Clint put a hand on Bobby's shoulder. "God, it's good to see you. Good to have you back." There was even a catch in his voice. Had us worried there for a while. Lee Chen handed him a glass of scotch on the rocks. "Don't do that again, okay?" "Don't plan to," Bobby said. No longer the smooth and self-assured performer Jackie Jacks had had enough for one night. "Listen, Bobby, I'm sure that whatever you have to tell us is fascinating, and you're bound to have come back with a lot of boffo anecdotes wherever you went, but I, for one, don't want to hear about it." "Boffo anecdotes?" Bobby said. Jackie shook his head. "Don't want to hear 'em. Sorry. It's my fault, not yours. I like showbiz 'cause it's a narrow life, you know? A thin little slice of the real world, but exciting 'cause it's all bright colors and loud music. You don't have to think in showbiz. You can just be. I just want to be, you know, perform, hang out, have fun. I got opinions, sure, colorful and loud opinions about everything, showbiz opinions. But I don't know a damn thing, and I don't want to know a damn thing, and I sure as hell don't want to know about what happened here tonight, because it's the kind of thing that turns your world upside down, makes you curious, makes you think, and then pretty soon you're no longer happy with all the things that made you happy before." He raised both hands as if to forestall argument and said, "I'm out of here." And a moment later, he was. At first, as he told the others what had happened to him, Bobby walked slowly around the room, marveling at ordinary items, finding wonder in the mundane, relishing the solidity of things. He put his hand on Julie's desk, and it seemed to him that nothing in the world was more wondrous than humble formica. All those molecules of man-made chemicals lined up in perfect, stable order. The framed prints of Disney characters, the inexpensive furniture, the half-empty bottle of scotch, the flourishing pothos plant on a stand by the windows, all of those things were suddenly precious to him. He had been traveling only 39 minutes. He took almost as long to tell them a condensed version. He had popped out of the office at 4:47 and returned at 5:26. But he'd done enough traveling, via teleportation or otherwise, to last the rest of his life. On the sofa, with Julie and Clint and Lee gathered around, Bobby said,
I want to stay right here in California. I don't need to see Paris. Don't need London. Not anymore. I want to stay where I have my favorite chair, sleep every night in a bed that's familiar. Damn right you will, Julie interjected. Drive my little yellow samurai, open a medicine cabinet where the anacin and toothpaste and mouthwash and Stipic pencil and Bactine and Band-Aids are exactly where they ought to be. By 6:15, Frank had not reappeared. During Bobby's account of his adventures, no one mentioned Frank's second disappearance or wondered aloud when he would return. But all of them kept glancing at the chair from which he had vanished initially and at the corner of the room from which he had dematerialized the second time. "How long do we wait here for him?" Julie finally asked.
"I don't know," Bobby said, "but I have a feeling, a real bad feeling, that maybe Frank's not going to regain control of himself this time, that he's just going to keep popping from one place to another faster and faster until sooner or later he's unable to put himself back together again."
When he came straight from Japan into the kitchen of his mother's house, Candy was seething with anger, and when he saw the cats on the table where he ate his meals, his anger grew into a full-blown rage. Violet was sitting in a chair at the table. Her ever-silent sister was in another chair beside her, hanging on her. Cats lay under the chairs and around their feet, and five of the biggest were on the table, eating bits of ham that Violet fed them.
"What are you doing?" he demanded.
Violet did not acknowledge him either with a word or a glance. Her gaze was locked with that of a dark gray mongrel that was sitting as erect as a statue of an Egyptian temple cat, patiently nibbling at a few small bits of meat offered on her pale palm.
"I'm talking to you,"
he said sharply, but she did not respond. He was sick of her silences, weary to death of her infinite strangeness. If not for the promise that he had made to his mother, he would have torn Violet open right there and fed on her. Too many years had passed since he had tasted the ambrosia in his sainted mother's veins, and he had often thought that the blood in Violet and Verbena was, in a way, the same blood that had flowed in Roselle. He wondered and sometimes dreamed of how his sister's blood might feel upon the tongue, how it might taste. Looming over her, staring down as she continued to commune with the gray cat, he said,
"This is where I eat, damn you!"
Violet said nothing, and Candy struck her hand, knocking the remaining bits of ham helter-skelter. He swept the plate of ham off the table as well and took tremendous satisfaction at the sound of it chattering on the floor. The five cats on the table were not the least startled by his fury, and the greater number on the floor remained unfazed by the ping and clatter of china fragments. At last, Violet turned her head, tilted it back, and looked up at Candy. Simultaneously with their mistress, the cats on the table turned their heads to look haughtily at him too, as if they wished him to understand what a singular honor they were bestowing upon him simply by granting him their attention. That same attitude was apparent in the disdain in Violet's eyes and in the faint smirk that curled the edges of her right mouth. More than once he had found her direct gaze withering, and he had turned away from her, rattled and confused. Certain that he was her superior in every way, he was perplexed by her unfailing ability to defeat him or force him into a hasty retreat with just a look. But this time would be different. He had never been as furious as he was at that moment, not even 7 years ago when he had found his mother's bloody, sundered body and had learned the axe had been wielded by Frank. He was angrier now, because that old rage had never subsided. It had fed on itself all these years, and on the humiliation of repeatedly failing to get his hands on Frank when the opportunities to do so arose. Now it was a midnight black bile that coursed in his veins and bathed the muscles of his heart and nourished the cells of his brain, where visions of vengeance were spawned in profusion. Refusing to be cowed by her stare, he seized her thin arm and jerked her violently to her feet. Verbena made a soft, woeful sound upon her separation from her sister, as if they were Siamese twins, for God's sake, as if tissue had been torn, bone split. Shoving his face close to Violet's, he sprayed her with spittle as he spoke.
Our mother had one cat, just one. She liked things clean and neat. She wouldn't approve of this mess, this stinking brood of yours.
Who cares?
Violet said in a tone of voice that was at once disinterested and mocking. She's dead. Grabbing her by both arms, he lifted her off her feet. The chair behind her fell over as he swung her away from it. He slammed her up against the pantry door so hard that the sound was like an explosion, rattling the loose kitchen windows and some dirty silverware on a nearby counter. He had the satisfaction of seeing her face contort with pain, and her eyes roll back in her head as she nearly passed out from the blow. If he had smashed her against the door any harder, her spine might have cracked. He dug his fingers cruelly into the pale flesh of her upper arms, pulled her away from the door, and slammed her into it again, though not as hard as before, just making the point that it might have been as hard, that it could be as hard the next time if she displeased him. Her head had fallen forward, for she was teetering on the edge of consciousness. Effortlessly, he held her against the door, with her feet 8 inches off the floor as if she weighed nothing at all, thereby forcing her to consider his incredible strength. He waited for her to come around. She was having difficulty getting her breath, and when at last she stopped gasping and raised her head to face him, he expected to see a different Violet. He had never struck her before. A fateful line had been crossed, one over which he never expected to trespass. With his promise to his mother in mind, he had kept his sisters safe from the often dangerous world outside, provided them with food, kept them warm in cold weather and cool in the heat, dry when it rained. But year after year he had performed his brotherly duties with growing frustration, appalled by their increasingly shameless and mysterious behavior. Now he realized that disciplining them was a natural part of protecting them. Up in heaven, his mother had probably despaired of his ever realizing the need for discipline. Thanks to his rage, he had stumbled upon enlightenment. It felt good to hurt Violet a little, just enough to bring her to her senses and to prevent her from spiraling further into the decadence and animal sensuality to which she had surrendered herself. He knew he was right to punish her. He waited eagerly for her to lift her head and face him, for he knew that they had entered a new relationship, and that the awareness of these profound changes would be evident in her eyes. At last, breathing somewhat normally, she raised her head and met Candy's gaze. To his surprise, none of his own enlightenment had been visited upon his sister. Her white blonde hair had fallen across her face, and she stared through it like a jungle animal peering through its wind-tossed mane. In her icy blue eyes, he perceived something stranger and more primitive than anything he had seen there before. A gleeful wildness. Indefinable hungers. Need. Though she had been hurt when he had thrown her against the pantry door, a smile played on her full lips again. She opened her mouth, and he felt her hot breath against his face as she said, "You're strong. Even the cats like the feel of your strong hands on me. And so does Verbena." He became aware of her long, bare legs, the flimsiness of her panties, the way her red t-shirt had pulled up to expose her flat belly, the swell of her full breasts, which seemed even fuller than they were because of the leanness of the rest of her, the sharp outlines of her nipples against the material of the shirt, the smoothness of her skin, her smell. Revulsion burst through him, like pus from a secret inner abscess, and he let go of her. Turning, he saw that the cats were looking at him. Worse, they were still lying where they had been when he had pulled Violet from her chair, as if they had not been frightened by his outrage, even briefly. He knew their equanimity meant that Violet had not been frightened either, and that her erotic response to his fury and her mocking smile was not in the least feigned. Verbena was slumped in her chair, her head bowed, for she was no more able to look at him directly now than she had ever been. But she was grinning, and her left hand was between her legs, her long fingers tracing lazy circles on the thin material of her panties, under which lay the dark cleft of her sex. He needed no more proof that some of Violet's sick desire had communicated itself to Verbena, and he turned away from her, too.
He tried to leave the room quickly, but without looking, as if he was fleeing from them. In his sanded bedroom, safely among his mother's belongings, Kendi locked the door. He was not sure why he felt safer with the lock engaged, though he was certain it was not because he feared his sisters. There was nothing about them to fear. They were to be pitied. For a while he sat in Roselle's rocker, remembering the times as a child when he'd curled in her lap and contentedly sucked blood from the self-inflicted wound in her thumb, or in the meaty part of her palm. Once, but unfortunately only once, she had made a half-inch incision in one of her breasts and held him to her bosom while he drank her blood from the same flesh where other mothers gave and other children received the milk of maternity. He had been 5 years old that night when, in this very room and in this chair, he tasted the blood of her breast. Frank, 7 years old then, had been asleep in the room at the end of the hall, and the twins, who'd only recently reached their first birthday, were asleep in a crib in the room across from their mother's. Being alone with her, when all the others slept, oh, how unique and treasured that made him feel, especially since she was sharing with him the rich liquid of her arteries and veins which she never offered to his siblings. It was a sacred communion, dispensed and received, that remained their secret. He recalled being in something of a swoon that night, not merely because of the heavy taste of her rich blood and the unbounded love that was represented by the gift of it, but because of the metronomic rocking of the chair and the lulling rhythms of her voice. As he sucked, she smoothed his hair away from his brow and spoke to him of God's intricate plan for the world. She explained, as she had done many times before, that God condoned the use of violence when it was committed in the defense of those who were good and righteous. She told him how God had created men who thrived on blood, so that they might be used as the earthly instruments of God's vengeance on behalf of the righteous. Theirs was a righteous family, she said, and God had sent Kendi to them to be their protector. None of this was new. But though his mother had spoken of these things many times during their secret communions, Kendi never grew tired of hearing them again. Children often relish the retelling of a favorite story. And as with certain particularly magical tales, this story somehow did not become more familiar with retelling, but curiously more mysterious and appealing. That night in his sixth year, however, the story took a new turn. The time had come, his mother said, for him to apply the truly amazing talents he had been given and embark upon the mission for which God had created him. He had begun to exhibit his phenomenal talents when he was 3, the same age at which Frank's far more meager gifts had become evident. His telekinetic abilities, primarily his talent for telekinetic transportation of his own body, particularly enchanted Roselle, and she quickly saw the potential. They would never want for money as long as he could teleport at night into places where cash and valuables were locked away, bank vaults, the jewelry-rich walk-in safes in Beverly Hills mansions. And if he could materialize within the homes of the Pollard family's enemies while they slept, vengeance could be taken without fear of discovery or reprisal. "There's a man named Selfont," his mother cooed to him as he took his nourishment from her wounded breast. "He's a lawyer, one of those jackals who prey on upstanding folks. Nothing good about him at all, not that one. He handled my father's estate, that's your dear grandpa, little Kendi. Probated the will, charged too much, way too much. He was greedy. They're all greedy, those lawyers." The quiet, gentle tone in which she spoke was at odds with the anger she was expressing, but that contradiction added to the sweet, hypnotic quality of her message. "I've tried for years to get part of the fee returned to me, like I deserve. I've gone to other lawyers, but they all say his fee was reasonable. They all stick up for each other. They're alike, peas in a pod, rotten little peas in rotten little pods. Took him to court, but judges are nothing except lawyers in black robes. They make me sick, the greedy lot of them. I've worried at this for years, little Kendi. Can't get it out of my mind. That Donald Selfont, living in his big house in Montecito, overcharging people, overcharging me. He ought to have to pay for that. Don't you think so, little Kendi? Don't you think he ought to pay?"
He was 5 years old.